Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. As always, I appreciate you taking the time to join us as we look back into the stacks and the boxes and the unopened wax of vintage baseball cards. Or sometimes they're not vintage, they're just classic, or they're junk wax, or they're just old and they're taking up space in our closets and our bookcases, but we still have them. We still hang on to them for some crazy reason. And looking forward to this show because we've got some truly vintage baseball cards. Finally, long time coming. And it took a little prodding from some of our listeners, but I finally got around to doing this. Adding to the vintage collection of mine with some Bowman cards from the early 1950s, we will be looking at a batch of cards, mostly from 1951. I've got one from 1952, one from 1954, and a handful from 1955. I don't have 1953 Bowman. Those are a little harder to come by, but I'm going to put out my feelers, my tentacles. I said tentacles. I'm going to put those out at the local card show, which is making its triumphant return to the nearby flea market here in Tampa Bay. Told you a little bit about that show a few weeks ago. And going to hopefully find that same dealer that I bought these cards from and go shuffling through the dollar box again, see if I get some 53 Bowman cards. When I was shuffling through the box that last time, I was, you know, just piling up these cards that looked good, and then I caught myself. I went, "Whoa, Matt, easy! this could be about $100 in purchases right here." So let's scale it back a bit. So I started putting some cards back in the box, but unbeknownst to me, I didn't take any 53 Bowmans home with me. Hopefully, I will do it this time around. But we're going to look back at some very interesting cards. You will see the growth of Bowman, the literal and figurative growth of Bowman, prodded by the growth, the rapid growth of Topps in the early 1950s. And I think you'll be entertained by some of the stories of these players. And that is something that I really took a lot of joy in discovering. You know, it's neat to have these vintage cards. It's even neater to get them at bargain basement prices. Like I said, most of these were marked down to a dollar. A few of them, and some of the Topps cards that you'll see in future weeks, a few of them were, you know, like $2 or $5. But most of these were for a buck, so why not? Sure, I'll just add them to the collection. But when you look at the players, some very interesting stories because for the most part, a couple of exceptions, you probably haven't heard of these players before. And when I did a little bit of research, thanks mostly to two resources, Wikipedia and also the great people at the Sabre Project, boy, you've got some real interesting tales to tell with some of these players. So we're going to do that a little later on in the program, look through that stack of Bowman cards. And just to give you a heads up, some of the other vintage cards that I have purchased that we will take a second look at include some from the early 50s Topps sets. I've got now at least one card from 52 through 56. I got a ton in 56. Well, not a ton. I've got about 20 of them, which is far more than I had before. It's more than zero. But in future shows, we will take a look at the 52 and 53. 54 we've already done, but we'll revisit that. And then also the 55 and 56. So that's something that we will, as I've mentioned before, kind of work into our junk wax era pack breaks, which we will start up again next week. I'll give you a little hint. We're going to call it Flippin' Fleer. I've got some cello packs from the 1980s. Fleer, some good years and some not so good years. But I'll let you decide which two we open up, and we'll see what players we get inside and talk a little bit about that. And we'll also be looking to add the occasional guest to the program. And my thanks again to Mike Chapman for joining us on last week, as he told us the great story about his father, who worked not only for Topps, but also Score, and also the parent company that made or makes Big League Chew and Bubble Tape and some of the other great candies that caused us to make a few more trips to the dentist office than our parents would have preferred. But Mike had a lot of great stories to share about his father, and we appreciate him for joining us. And Mike and I spoke briefly after the show was released, and he said it was just a real fun walk down memory lane for him. And before we had done the interview, he was talking to his dad a little more to get some more information from him. And it was fun for his dad as well. So Mike was chiming in, enjoying the program. His sister as well mentioned that it was a nice little walk down memory lane for her. So that was great that she was able to chime in, help us promote the show too. And if you look through our mentions at Wax and Gum Stains, our Twitter feed, a little deeper, you will see Mr. Chapman, the main character of our story here, as he chimed in. I hope he enjoyed reliving some of the great times that he had in the mid to late 80s and early 90s selling these baseball cards. And I know we had a lot of listeners who really enjoyed that. So thanks again to Mike for joining us and being part of the program. And also, whether he knew it or not when he was a kid, being part of our lives through his father, who helped sell a lot of these cards wholesale throughout the Northeast and the Atlantic region in the time when the hobby was ramping up into a mass business effort. And unfortunately, it ramped up a little too quickly, and even his dad was able to realize that it just was not going to last. So he got out at the right time, but a lot of the cards that he sold, some of us still have some of them, and some of us are still looking for them. So a lot of fun on that program. And like I said, we're going to try to get not too many guests, because I'm looking for people who have had an impact in the hobby, or people who have a very interesting story to tell. But just like the vintage cards and the junk wax era pack opens, we'll just kind of shuffle in and out of those topics over the next few weeks as Wax Ecstatic continues its summer run. We are coming your way every Friday at noon Eastern, not only the audio podcast that you're listening to, but we do have video links posted at YouTube. We send those out during our prompts on Twitter at Wax and Gum Stains, so you can watch the pack breaks. On today's program, you can take a look at these Bowman cards. Now, I have already teased with a picture of the Bowman cards on Wax and Gum Stains, but we're going to talk a little more in depth about the actual cards themselves. So you can watch those on YouTube. Make sure you forward those links and like them, comment on them as well. And we come your way not only via Audio Boom, which is our home base, but also iTunes, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, TuneIn, Blueberry. It's all out there. We're there, and we appreciate you listening. If you have a chance to rate the program, I know you can on iTunes, but various platforms, if you can give us 5 stars or comment on it, please do, because not only does that tell us that you actually like the program, but it also, the way the algorithms for programs such as iTunes, the more positive feedback you get from listeners, the show gets bumped up the ladder, it gets promoted a little bit more. We also take the occasional cash donation. Again, if you have donated to Wax Ecstatic, thank you very much. If you haven't yet, please, if you can find it in your heart, just for a buck or two, we appreciate it, as that money goes back into the purchase of the packs that we break, but also into the maintenance of the Audio Boom website and the archive, which is then shared on iTunes and iHeartRadio and you name it. PayPal.me/WaxEcstatic. Again, that's PayPal.me/WaxEcstatic. Any donation is greatly appreciated. It does not go to my bank account. It does not go to my personal spending habits. It certainly will not put my kids through college. So just be aware that any donation you make goes right back into the program, and we appreciate your support. Now let's talk about the Bowman baseball cards, as we will be taking a look at those 1950s era cards in just a few minutes. But the history of Bowman is very interesting. I went into it in great length when we did our 1989 Bowman show a couple of years ago. You can find that in our archives with Jose Canseco as the star player, the featured card from that set. But I'll give you the brief rundown here. I've got some more information about the gentleman who founded the Bowman Baseball Card Company, and that would be Jacob Warren Bowman. He wasn't looking for baseball cards. He was just looking for a way to pay his bills and most notably his numerous ex-wives. But I'll give you the short version of it here, because how we got to the baseball cards of today, Bowman has a very, very big part in that story. Now, you can find a great retelling of the history at the Topps website. When Bowman celebrated its 70th anniversary last season, there was a great historical discussion of the Bowman brand. Even though Bowman baseball cards weren't around for more than 30 years, they still looked at it as a 70th anniversary. So Topps did a really good recounting of the history on their website last year. But also, if you read Dave Jameson's book, Mint Condition, he really dives into the baseball card hobby in the late 1930s and early 1940s. It was something completely different than what we know of today. And in fact, the baseball card of today really wasn't created until the mid-1950s. And for the most part, it's been very similar in terms of design and standards ever since then. And part of the reason why that is the war that went on between Bowman and Topps throughout the early 1950s, both inside the wax packs with the cards and, more importantly, in the courthouses too. Hence, there was a lot of litigation going on between these two teams. But let's talk a little bit about Jacob Warren Bowman. He was a bit of a playboy in the 1920s. He bounced around from job to job, couldn't really find anything that really stuck with him. However, he, as legend goes, he was on a train one day in the mid-1920s. He met up with a chewing gum salesman, a bubblegum salesman, and they hit it off. And eventually, Bowman starts his own gum company, appropriately called Gum Inc. He starts it in 1927 in Philadelphia. And shortly after starting it, he created a brand of gum called Blowney Bubblegum. That's Blowney, not what you were thinking you heard. Blowney Bubblegum, B-L-O-N-Y, a little bit of a play on words of America's favorite mechanically separated lunch meat, bologna. So Blowney Bubblegum is created in the late 1920s and very quickly becomes the top brand of bubblegum, you know, penny gum, in the United States. And one of the reasons why it became popular was the advertising and the promotion that Bowman put around it. And it really flew in the early 1930s during the Great Depression, when it was advertised as the one piece of gum you could get three big bites. So three big bites for a penny. And a lot of products in the early 30s advertise the value that you got with them. Pepsi Cola was famous for, you know, how they pitched their product was a nickel, but because you got more in a bottle of Pepsi than Coke, it was a great deal. And you would find that in advertising for very common items. So yeah, you could buy a piece of penny gum anywhere, but as opposed to the small gumballs or individually wrapped pieces, the Blowney bubblegum was slightly larger than the others, so you got, as they, you know, advertised, three big bites for a penny. Well, Blowney and Gum Inc. Really blew up in the 1930s, and it made J. Warren Bowman, as he would be later more formally known as, a millionaire. And that's quite the turnaround from a guy who just bounced around from various sales jobs. All of a sudden, he had a ton of money in his pockets. And it was rather well-timed, because It turns out that J. Warren Bowman was a candy man in more than one way. He had four ex-wives, so a lot of alimony. So that's where a lot of his money went in the 1930s. Yeah, he made a fortune. He was one of the few Americans who was freakishly rich in the 1930s, but a lot of that went back to the various women in his life. But the company was extremely popular, made a fortune throughout the 1930s and into the 1940s. And Bowman was very smart in realizing that not only could he sell the economical value of his bubble gum, but there was promotional value as well. And you saw this with bubble gum and other candy products at the time. For example, Bazooka Joe bubble gum, you know, inserting the comics in with the gum. And Bowman went back to an old-fashioned way of promoting his product, putting in pictures of baseball cards, or putting in pictures of baseball players, I should say, in the form of baseball cards. Baseball cards in the 1930s, nothing new. You know, it starts back in the tobacco card era, the late 1880s, I should say. And, you know, Bowman and Gum Inc. were not the first makers of baseball cards. This was not a revolutionary new product. But along with baseball cards, there were other cards that were put into gum packs, mostly non-sports stuff. So one of the brands of cards that Bowman put out in the 1930s was the Horrors of War. And as the name implies, that's what it showed. It showed, you know, heroic drawings of, you know, great moments in battle history. But also, you know, there was a strip of cards that basically demeaned Japanese warriors, and the nation of Japan was not too pleased with that. Actually, it took Bowman to court, although that case apparently didn't go very far. Also, you had Mickey Mouse, you had Heroes of the Law, you had Superman, you had G-Men, you know, really pumping the tires of the FBI following the days of, you know, cracking down on the mafia throughout America. So you had those non-sports cards. You had the Play Ball brand of cards that came out in 1939, 40, and 41. Well, after 1941, the game changes thanks to World War II. The card releases were cut back tremendously because a lot of the products needed to make the cards went to the war effort. So World War II plays out, and then we go into post-war world, and the first Bowman brand of cards comes out in 1948. It's a 48-card black and white set, very, very basic. Little squares featuring pictures of players. The cards were measuring at 2 1/16 of an inch by 2.5 inches, certainly smaller than what you're used to today, which is 2.5 by 3.5 inches. So it's a 48-card set in 1948. By 1949, the set grows to 240 cards, and color is added to the pictures. And with baseball booming again in the late 1940s, coinciding with the baby boom at the time, also the shift to the suburbs, America moving out west in droves as people had extra money, and, you know, returning servicemen had the GI Bill to, you know, finish their college education, to build houses, to get loans for property and cars and stuff like that. You know, the game of baseball was growing. Well, naturally, the hobby of creating and collecting baseball cards did as well. So by 1950, Bowman, which had muscled out Leaf in the creation of cards, Bowman is now the only card company creating a 324-card set, and they were the only game in town for that 1 year. But then, in 1951, Topps comes along. Now, Topps is really not a threat to Bowman at the time, because Topps, as you know, the red back and blue back cards of 1951, very basic, kind of like the 48 Bowman set in terms of size. They were nearly perfect squares. You had a black and white headshot of a player with, you know, really the baseball card was more of a game piece. It wasn't a baseball card as we know it. Well, in 1952, Topps changes their game completely. Topps comes out with the 2 1/8 inch by 3 1/8 inch card, a much bigger card. And Topps has these great portraits in the 1952 set. It's full of color. The backs of the cards have statistics on it. It's not just narrative, as you'll see. I'll show you in just a couple minutes here the difference between a 1952 Bowman card and a 1952 Topps card. And Bowman realizes very quickly, there's a new kid in town here, and we've got to improve our game. Because the Bowman cards of 1951 and 52, as you'll see, not all that different, just some very minor differences. Well, in 1953, Bowman rolls out what is arguably one of the best sets in not only 1953, but the 1950s, as Topps, kind of pushes them in this direction. Bowman goes out and increases their card size. Instead of just painting pictures, they're using full color Kodachrome pictures, and the cards are extremely simple. It's just the picture of the player on the front. There's no name on there. There's no team logo. There's no facsimile autograph. It's just the name or just the picture of the player. And then on the back, you've got some more statistics and stuff, you know, things that were incorporated from what Topps was doing. And the 53 Bowman set kind of puts Bowman on par with Topps. And as you'll see, much improved products in 1954 and the legendary 55 Bowman set, where the pictures of the players were included inside a facsimile TV set frame. And it's a very popular design that when Bowman came back in 1989, underneath the Topps tutelage, Bowman, you know, created a 1989 version of the TV card. Didn't quite look as good as the 55 Bowmans did, but it was a nod to their history. And that is also one reason why the 89 Bowman set is the way it is, why the cards are larger than the average cards, why they were just mostly photographs. They did have the facsimile autograph on the front. Collectors didn't like it then. They still don't, for the most part, like it now. But it was the 89 Bowman set was a throwback to the 1950s set, in particular 1953, which unfortunately in 1989 collectors really didn't care much for. And like I said, a lot of them still don't to this day. Now, while Bowman was improving their product and making inroads in design and going toe-to-toe with Topps with the better-looking cards, when it came to player contracts, exclusive contracts, Bowman could not win the game. Now, J. Warren Bowman, by 1952, had sold his interest in gum ink and the baseball card production. He sold it off to a company, and he goes down to Florida, where he becomes a real estate developer. He owned some luxurious hotels and townhomes on St. Petersburg Beach, and that's basically where he lived until his death in 1962 and what he was doing then. You know, he tried to find some success in selling some other things, but basically he hit on the real estate boom of post-war Central Florida, which was a very big boom, and Bowman, the man, gives up on the Bowman baseball card and gum work, sells it off to a company that just has no chance of going up against Topps. As the Bowman Baseball Card Company at that time was run by Helen Laboratories, another company based in Philadelphia that wanted to get in on the action of the ever-growing hobby of baseball cards. So Bowman and Topps are sending out scouts to every spring training site across America, and they are getting players to sign these contracts that would allow the card company to use their image and likeness to print up baseball cards. So you had some card companies that had big stars for Topps who didn't sign with Bowman, and vice versa. So you had this interesting little war brewing between these two companies, including, Jackie Robinson signing exclusively for Topps. Well, Topps had Jackie Robinson but they couldn't get Stan Musial or Ralph Kiner. So some of the biggest stars were leveraging these card companies against one another. And all of a sudden, what the card companies were willing to pay these players to appear on these baseball cards, the numbers were starting to get, I wouldn't say astronomical, but they were ramping up so much so that this little laboratory in Philadelphia, who was running the Bowman operation at the time, they over time had no chance to go into the deeper pockets of the Topps chewing gum company. So you have this war of attrition, basically, where Topps just goes all in on signing all the players they can. Bowman tries to stay in there, but eventually Bowman loses out, not only because they can't afford to sign more of the big name players to exclusive contracts, but also in court cases. These two companies were sniping back and forth in court for many years. And finally, Bowman basically gave up and was sold to the Topps Chewing Gum Company. And like any good competitor, Topps immediately closes down the Bowman brand, and Topps would have a monopoly on the baseball card market for the next 25 years until the Fleer Company in the mid-1970s starts toying around with baseball cards. And for more on that, listen to our first podcast on 1980 Topps, featuring Len Barker. We give you the full history of how Fleer infiltrated the monopoly for Topps, and eventually the courts ruled in the late summer of 1980 that Topps had a monopoly, and they needed to open up competition. That opened the door for Fleer and Donruss to come around in 1981, and the card industry was never the same since. So Bowman would get reintroduced, as I mentioned, in 1989, not to much fanfare. Topps very quickly, resizing the cards, adding a little more color and pizzazz in 1990. But by 1990, and certainly in 1991, Bowman starts becoming the card for the rookie card. So if you were a rookie card collector, you focused in on Bowman, and Topps realized that there was a market for the rookie card niche. And starting in 1992, I would say they really zoned in on rookie cards, not just guys who were making their major league debuts that season, but guys who were 2, 3, or 4 years away. But that was the way that you got the true rookie card for your favorite player, or if you're a speculator on who's going to be a big star from a rookie, Bowman was the brand that you went to. And by the mid-1990s, Bowman branded themselves as the rookie card set. So there's your history of Bowman, and it starts with some of these fascinating cards from the 1950s that we're going to take a look at right now. This is damage from people taking scrap paper glue and, putting it on the back, and then they would take the card and smack it onto basically a photo album. They would scrapbook with baseball cards. So it's a little tough sometimes when you're getting these cards, you'll have this on the back. But as I've stated many times, when it comes to vintage cards, unless I am buying a star card or a semi-star card from the set, I am not all that particular in the quality of the card. As long as it's not completely ripped to shreds and it's offered at a good price, I will go ahead and get it. Now also, excuse me, you can look at the back of this Dick Whitman card, and you'll see it on the backs of the others. This was the standard fare for the back of a baseball card. Not really a whole lot of stats, not a whole lot of numbers like we know of today, but narrative. You had in this tiny space here, this was your Wikipedia. Back in 1951, this was how you learned more about Dick Whitman or whatever baseball player it was. It was basically just 3 or 4 short sentences describing his career. And you've got some stats. You've got a little bit of detail about the previous season. And as often is the case of players who were playing at this time, you've got some kind of military record here. As it mentions, he spent 2 seasons with the armed forces. So that's Dick Whitman. Let's take a look at the other cards from 1951. Sid Gordon here with the Boston Braves. As you will find out, he was a very popular player.
not just in Boston and later Milwaukee when the Braves moved, but especially in his native New York. He was beloved by a lot of the population in the New York City area. Also, the name may not imply it, but Sid Gordon was Jewish and was one of the best Jewish players in baseball history. He still ranks in the top five or top 10 in offensive categories for Jewish-born players. And here, if, as we flip this over, you could see you don't have the glue scrap that's, you know, causing problems with the Dick Whitman card here. You've got a nice clean back here. You see the creases and everything. But again, for a card that is approaching 70 years old, this is actually in pretty darn good shape here. And again, the mind-blowing thing for me is, you know, I got this for a dollar at the card show. You know, if it was in gem mint condition, it'd be worth a lot more, and probably not too many people are clamoring for a Sid Gordon card from 1951, but it's really in great condition, all things considered. Now, here's a player, you're going to hear the story of George Snuffy Sternweiss, an amazing and tragic story, a very, very talented player who died way too young. And of all of the New York Yankees players to have won a batting title in the American League, I guarantee you, Snuffy Sternweiss is the last one in that list you would think of. But yes, he was a leader in hitting in the American League in his career. An interesting thing about this card, as you flip it over, you see it says second base, Cleveland Indians, although clearly, if you look at the front, he's pictured with the St. Louis Browns. But we get to the bottom of the card here, and it says, Snuffy was traded from the Browns to the Indians just as this card was going to press. So what we have here is the 1951 version of the traded card, or the traded set. The trade from St. Louis to Cleveland happened in April 1951, I believe, right before the season started. So Bowman was about to go to press with this. The trade happens. Well, they didn't have enough time to go back and, you know, certainly not airbrush, but color over the Browns logo and try to clean up the jersey here. It was too late. So they did have enough time to add this line in here, and I thought that was very neat. We have Carl Scheib, not to be confused with Earl Scheib, who will paint your car for $99.95. A bit of a scuff here. That's the only blemish really on that card other than a few creases. But Carl Scheib, as you will hear, an amazing career, not necessarily in total numbers, but when and how he got started, still the youngest player in American League history, or the youngest player to make his debut in the major leagues in the American League at the tender age of 16. That's a record I don't think will get broken. And Gil Cohn here, shown with the Washington Senators. As you will find out, Gil Cohn, in terms of his career numbers, doesn't really stand out much, didn't have a lengthy major league career, was the minor league player of the year in 1945, but here's something that's amazing about Gil Cohn. You see his birth date, May 18th, 1924. Gil Cohn is still alive. Yes, he is, how old is he now? 94 years old. So I think he's still alive. We'll find out in just a little bit. I got to check my notes here. But this is a great picture here, too. I mean, just yucking it up probably at spring training. But we'll talk about him in just a little bit. Now, I've got one card from 1952, and you will see the 1952 card, not all that different from 1951. It's the same size. It is still the colorized portrait. Really, the only difference is 1951, you had a little box with the player's name. 1952, you have the facsimile autograph, which really would have been a big deal for collectors, you know, mostly kids at the time, because unless you lived in a major league city, you weren't going to get a, you know, Roy Hartsfield autograph at this point in time. But, you know, very unique feature there. You'll see when I show you the Topps card, that was something that Topps did as well. Flip the card over, 1952 Bowman, very similar to 1951 Bowman, you know, mostly, text, almost the exact same design. The only difference is with this card from 1952, there's a little advertisement here. Get a dollar value baseball cap of your favorite major league team by sending 5 wrappers and 50 cents to, and then here's the mailing address that you could send it to. So Bowman didn't do much from 1951 to 1952. However, Topps did. And let me show you the 1952 Topps card, and we'll talk a little more in detail about the 52 Topps set and this particular player, Vic Wirtz. This is another card that I pulled from the dollar bin, other than a few scuff marks here. Remarkably tremendous condition. But you can see, you know, Topps went from the standard baseball card in 1951 to this beauty. Bowman is still producing these small things here. And you can look at it as I place the Bowman on top of the Topps card. I mean, the Topps card pretty much eats it up. It's almost picture in picture here. So Bowman seeing Topps put out this beauty of a set, and, you know, Bowman's putting this out, which is nice, but, you know, not spectacular. You could see as soon as they saw the 52 Topps set, they went, ooh, we got to up our game here. The irony is that the 52 Topps set was not a very good seller. There's the legendary story of the Topps company dumping cases of the 52 Topps set into the Atlantic Ocean. They couldn't sell them. They couldn't get rid of them. And that's one of the reasons why the 52 Topps set is so valuable. But Bowman was certainly up to its neck in the competition. That's why in 1953 they made the bigger, more colorful cards, which again, unfortunately, I don't have as of the moment. But you'll see the jump made from 1952 to 1954. Now, the price tag here is on the card holder. It is not on the card, so forget that distraction. Marian Fricano, we'll talk about him briefly in just a little bit, but you could see by 1954, Bowman has clearly upped their game, where it's not a painting of a player that's colorized. They have now colorized the picture. You've got the faux autograph down here as well, but also, again, taking the Roy Hartsfield card, they have standardized their card size. They are also the same size. Let me pull the Topps card back out. They are almost the same size as 52 Topps was, or, you know, 1954 Topps was still this size. And you'll see on the back, still carrying on the narrative, but you're starting to see more statistics, more numbers, which is something that Topps did a lot more in 1952 and moving forwards. So Bowman was definitely up to the call with their competition, at least in terms of what the quality of the product was. As I mentioned, there was a war of attrition between the two card companies in signing players to contracts, and that's what ultimately what did Bowman in. Something I want to mention about this card, while it's typically higher series cards of vintage sets, so 1973 and prior, the higher number cards are typically the more valued cards because higher number series were released later, typically released in smaller batches because retailers were still selling the first few series of a set by the time the high numbers came out in June and July. You can also put a premium price on the extremely low number cards because in the 1950s especially, kids who collected these, if they didn't put them in the spokes of their tires, and if you look back at the older cards here, I mean, you could see why kids put these in their bicycle tires. I mean, they were nice and small and, you know, just with a little paper clip, you could, you know, clip it to a spoke and make all sorts of clicky-clack noise. Well, the stacks of cards, if kids collected them, they often wrapped rubber bands around them, and they would wrap them very tightly around them. And if it was a thick rubber band, then it would squeeze the sides of the cards. This is number 3 in the 54 Bowman set, and for a card number 3, it's again an incredible condition here, so I really appreciate whoever had this card since 1954 taking good care of it for all of these years. And finally, we've got a few cards from 1955 to show you. We'll start off, this is, and again, we've got the prices here on the corners here. This here is a catcher for the New York Giants, Ray Catt. We'll talk about him in a little bit. Let's look at the back first. Again, you've got the narrative and the stats here. Not all that different from what you saw in 1954, but just a slightly different way of presenting the numbers. But Bowman going with the same type of presentation on the back, but on the front, really unique. And I'm going to take the card out of the holder here so that the price tag doesn't totally interfere with me. There we go. This is a legendary set because it is designed to look like a television. This was your standard television. And of course, with the colorization of the photographs, Bowman made sure to point out it was color TV. This would be the last set that Bowman made up until 1989. And it was a beauty. They went out with a bang. As you have the colorization, you have the very unique design here, and it's something that more than 60 years later is still very memorable and beloved by collectors. And I love this. This is not just a posed shot. I mean, it is posed, but it is made to look like an action shot. You have this is Shy Park in the background in Philadelphia. So let's quickly look at the other two cards. Speaking of Shy Park, I believe we've got the same makeup here as we have another catcher, Toby Atwell, who's with the Pittsburgh Pirates at that time. And you've got players in the background. They're probably warming up, but with this action here of him holding his mask up, you know, it looks like he's about to make a play in foul territory. And then finally, we've got a relief pitcher here with the Baltimore Orioles, although, as you'll find out, best remembered for his time with the New York Yankees, won three World Series with the Yankees from 1951 through 1953. Bob Kuzeva, a lefty who didn't have a stellar career, but boy, he had a lengthy career, I believe 13 seasons in the bigs. You could say he was one of the first left-handed specialist relief pitchers, as the role of the reliever starting in the mid-1950s was changing to where lefties were more specialist. So there you go. We've got our 55s here. We've got our one card from 1954. I hope I can get a card from 53. And then you've got the 52 Roy Hartsfield in the stack of 1951 Bowman. So quite the growth from small, almost cigarette box style cards to big, full color, lots of information, and then ultimately in the final version, a creative genius by the Bowman Company. So we know a lot about Bowman cards from that era. You're not going to believe some of the stories of some of these players here.
So we've looked at the cards. We've seen some of the differences between the Topps and Bowman cards in the mid-50s. Let's take a look briefly at some of the players. First of all, Dick Whitman. All right, I mentioned as we were looking at it that I can't find any evidence that Dick Whitman, the ball player, somehow crossed paths with somebody who was a writer or Matt Weiner, who created the Madman series. But as I mentioned before, Dick Whitman was the birth name of the Don Draper character. And during the Korean War, as you know, mentioned in the show, the real Dick Whitman dies under friendly fire. Don Draper's, or let me back that up there. The real Don Draper dies from friendly fire from Dick Whitman. So Dick Whitman, seeing this happen, takes Don Draper's dog tags, and immediately, all of a sudden, John Hamm, who plays the role of Don Draper, well, he becomes Don Draper. And that's one of the underlying storylines through the Mad Men series, is the dark, shady past of Dick Whitman, as opposed to the glossy, advertised sales guy Don Draper, which he created after this unfortunate incident. But you'll have to watch Mad Men for more of that. But I, as a fan of Mad Men, absolutely loved finding this Dick Whitman card. Dick Whitman was actually winding down his career in 1951. He did play for a couple of National League pennant winners, the 1949 Brooklyn Dodgers and 1950 Philadelphia Phillies, both teams losing to the Yankees in the World Series. Now, there is kind of a Mad Men tie-in here in that this Dick Whitman also served in active duty. He served in World War II, not the Korean War, but he was a member of the 83rd Infantry Division. He was a master sergeant, and he suffered shrapnel wounds and frostbite at the Battle of the Bulge. He was awarded the Purple Heart and Bronze Star for bravery in battle, along with three battle stars. So there's the war angle there. The only other thing that I can think of that puts the real Dick Whitman into the orbit of Mad Men is that according to the biography of the fictitious Dick Whitman, he was from the Philadelphia area. So that, you know, here's the player Dick Whitman playing for Philadelphia. The character Dick Whitman was from Philadelphia. So that's the only other possibility that I see these two kind of, you know, in a Venn diagram crossing over these two circles just a little bit. An interesting story about the real Dick Whitman. His major league career had wound down, but by 1954, he was in the Dodgers organization playing for their AAA club in Montreal, the Montreal Royals. And he was often put out on the field as opposed to a young prospect for the Dodgers, an outfielder named Roberto Clemente. Yeah, a lot of people don't know Roberto Clemente was actually scouted and drafted, or not drafted, signed by the Dodgers after 1953, and he played the entire 1954 season in Montreal. Some people say the Dodgers were trying to hide Clemente because they were going to lose him to an intra-league draft, the way that things worked with free agent players back then. So they basically tried to hide him and you know, not bring him up to the big leagues. Of course, there were some pretty good outfielders for the Brooklyn Dodgers at that time, so that's another factor. And some accounts just say that, you know, the manager for Montreal, Max Makem, was just a big fan of platooning. And you know, he just went with the veteran Dick Whitman as opposed to the 18-year-old Roberto Clemente. Whitman would retire and settle in San Jose, California, worked for the local water company until his retirement from that in the 1980s. And then he moved to Arizona in the 90s, was apparently a very big fan of the Arizona Diamondbacks, and he passed away in February of 2003. Now, speaking of Brooklyn, let's talk about Sig Gordon here. I mentioned, even though this card shows him with the Boston Braves, he was beloved in his native Brooklyn, born and raised there. He was such a prodigy at the sport of baseball when he was in high school. His coach introduced him to Casey Stengel, who was the manager of the Dodgers back in the mid-1930s. Stengel liked what he saw in Sig Gordon, but the Dodgers didn't like what they saw in Casey Stengel. They fired him. So basically, the chance of Sig Gordon playing for his home team then, well, that evaporated. A couple years later, he is signed off of a sandlot squad by the rival New York Giants. He makes his major league debut in September 1941. He, too, serving in duty during the World War II with the Coast Guard from 1944 to 45. Returns to the Giants in 1946. He was an all-star in 1948 and 1949. And I said Sig Gordon was well-liked. Here's how well-liked he was. He was honored with a Sig Gordon Day at the Polo Grounds, given several gifts by the Giants and their fans. Nothing unusual. A lot of teams actually did that back then. Well, here's what's unusual. He had a second Sig Gordon Day at Ebbets Field. The Dodgers honored Sig Gordon. He didn't even play for them. So that's very odd when, you know, unless you're a Mickey Mantle or a Babe Ruth or a Ted Williams, you know, the other team normally doesn't acknowledge you with your own day. But Sig Gordon had his own day at both the Polo Grounds and Ebbets Field. By the way, he finished fourth in MVP voting in 1948. He was traded to the Braves in 1949. It was not a very very popular trade. But he was a power hitter, not a lot of speed. Well, new manager Leo Durocher wanted some speed on the base paths. So Sid Gordon got traded to Boston, and the owner of the Giants, Horace Stoneham, actually sent an I'm sorry note to Gordon and $2,500. He basically felt so bad that he traded him. Gordon would later play for the Pirates, and he'd circle back to the Giants once again. Sadly died at the age of 57 when he was playing softball in Central Park in New York. Again, an outstanding hitter, very popular, had a great eye too. He didn't strike out that often. And as I mentioned while looking at the cards, his Jewish heritage puts him in a very special category. He is one of the most offensively talented Jewish-born baseball players, and still, all these years later, is still in the top 10 of many offensive categories. Now, George Snuffy Sternweiss, this is an amazing story, tragic too, but just an incredible story. He was an infielder, and when he was growing up, much like Sid Gordon, really stood out in high school in the Bronx. He played basketball, baseball, and football for Fordham Prep, which was a high school located on the Fordham University campus. Now, I'm reading a book on Vince Lombardi right now, and Lombardi played defense for Fordham University at around the time that Sternweiss was at Fordham Prep. So even though Lombardi would go on to play professionally for a couple of years and then start his coaching career at the high school ranks, it's tempting to think, had Sternweiss gone to Fordham University, he could have been under the tutelage of a lot of former teammates and coaches who led the way for Vince Lombardi. That was not the case, though. He was snatched up by the University of North Carolina and was an all-star, if you will, there, especially in football and baseball. He was drafted by the Chicago Cardinals, but he chose an offer from the Yankees instead. That is not all that unusual at the time. The NFL was nothing like it is nowadays. So even if you were a high draft pick of an NFL team, if the Yankees came around, it's 1940 and the Pinstripes are knocking on your door, guess what? You're going to the Yankees. So while many players went to serve overseas in World War II, Sternweiss, who had a very bad ulcer, which disqualified him from serving, was able to take advantage of the World War II call-ups, as he was called up to the Yankees in 1943, at first replacing Phil Rizzuto at shortstop. And then when Joe Gordon went overseas, he shifted from shortstop to second base. He was one of the top hitters in 1944. He led the American League in batting in 1945, actually finished third in MVP voting. And he was an all-star in 1945 and 1946. Now, after the war ended, and you had Joe Gordon and Phil Rizzuto come back stateside, and eventually Joe Gordon would get replaced by Billy Martin. Well, with Gordon and Martin and Rizzuto in front of him, all of a sudden Sternweiss becomes a utility player, and his production falls off the map, bounces around from team to team here. And when his playing days ended in 1952, he becomes a manager in the minor leagues. And in fact, he's in the Yankees farm club. He's trying to move up the ladder quickly, but it's not happening. So he gets out of baseball. And then this is where the tragedy starts coming his way. He's got a family to support. He's got life after baseball to deal with here. And he also infamously held out for higher contracts when he was playing. So here's a guy who's trying to make ends meet. He gets into the banking industry. But in 1957, he suffers some severe medical crisis. It's not really known what he suffered. Some people think it's a heart attack. Others think it was some kind of an infection from the ulcer that he had. But basically, his banking career, done. Still a young man here. He's working for a warehouse company. And in 1958, he is on train number 3314 of the Central Railroad of New Jersey. He's going into Manhattan for reasons unknown. The train goes through several signals and flies off of the Newark Bailift Bridge and into Newark Bay. The Newark Bailift Bridge, it was a drawbridge, and the bridge is up, and the train just plunges into the water. Sternweiss was one of the passengers on board, one of 48 people who died in that train wreck. He was only 39 years old. Now, a very interesting footnote to Sternweiss's life and career. I mentioned he was able to take advantage of Phil Rizzuto getting called to serve his country, so he replaced Rizzuto at shortstop. Well, in 1956, when the Yankees basically forced Rizzuto into retirement, Rizzuto was livid. He didn't think he was done yet. He still had some good years left in him. Well, Sternweiss, remember, he was still working for the Yankees in their minor league system. He reaches out to Rizzuto and says, "Hey, man, you got to, you know, back off, just cool down. You know, take a few days, settle down with your family, just let this blow over." And Rizzuto would recall very late in his career, in fact, according to the folks at Sabre, this was a 1994 interview, and I quote, "It was great advice because when I came back, I was offered a broadcasting job. If I had popped off, I would have made people mad and I'd never have gotten it." And that's amazing because Phil Rizzuto, you know, the Scooter, he was part of Yankees broadcast for, what, 40 years after that. So while Snuffy Sternweiss was able to take advantage of Rizzuto's absence to create a very short but successful major league career, it was Snuffy Sternweiss whose advice to Phil Rizzuto created a very long career in broadcasting. And Phil Rizzuto was one of the first and certainly the most successful of the early athletes turned color analyst. And any former athlete who is a color analyst in television or radio these days owes Phil Rizzuto a debt of gratitude, but of course, by extension, owes the late Snuffy Sternweiss a debt of gratitude, because if it wasn't for his advice to Rizzuto to just calm down, things could have turned out completely differently. All right, Carl Scheib grows up in tiny Gratz, Pennsylvania. This is another incredible story. Scheib grows up in this town of Gratz, population about 800, cut off from most civilization. It's just one of your typical, you know, Dutch country small towns in Pennsylvania. Well, he was scouted out by a local grocery clerk, a young lady named Hannah Clark. Clark had never been to a baseball game, but she knew good baseball when she saw it. She also knew that as a woman in the 1930s, nobody was probably going to pay attention to her with the Philadelphia Athletics. So she gets together with a traveling salesman named Al Grossman. Grossman does have connections with the A's. And he tells Connie Mack about this kid in Gratz, Pennsylvania, who's a pretty darn good pitcher. Well, Connie Mack invites Scheib and his dad to Connie Mack Stadium and likes what he sees. He encourages Scheib to go back to school, but in 1943, the next season, come back here. Let's see if we can make you part of this team. So in April of 1943, Carl Scheib's father tells his son he's best off dropping out of school and playing professional baseball. And the A's sign Scheib as a batting practice pitcher. Why? Because Carl Scheib is 16 years old. He was also better than a batting practice pitcher. He had good stuff, good control, and long story short, makes his major league debut at 16 on September 6th, 1943. He is still the youngest player to make a major league debut in the American League. He would be the youngest pro player until Joe Nuxhall made his debut at the age of 15 in 1944. Again, this is all happening during World War II. Teams are just desperate to get any warm, healthy bodies into the lineup. So they allowed some exceptions. You know, high school teenagers are pitching in the big leagues. And of course, the Philadelphia Athletics didn't exactly have a stocked farm system. So why not go for this young fireballing kid from Gratz, Pennsylvania that the local store clerk told me about? Well, he is mostly used in relief. After the war, he becomes more of a factor in the Philadelphia pitching staff. And his best season would be in 1948. He goes 14-8 with a 3.94 earned run average. He helps the A's get to their best winning season. They went 84-70 in 1948. It was their best season since 1932, and it would turn out to be their best season until 1970. That's how bad the A's were. There's a stretch of 38 years where they had only one pretty decent season, and it would be the last time the Philadelphia A's would have a run at the pennant. But he struggled the next few seasons. His arm would wear out, and his career ended after a brief stint with the St. Louis Cardinals in 1954. Later, he would operate a service station and car wash. Gil Cohn, I was a little hazy on remembering if he was still alive. He is. In fact, he is the oldest living member of the New York Giants. I mentioned he was the Sporting News Minor League Player of the Year in 1945. Meanwhile, with the Washington Senators in 1950 and 51, he batted .303 in each of those two seasons. Following his career, Cohn entered the insurance business. He has owned and operated the Brevard Insurance Agency starting in 1962. After his retirement in 1986, his son and grandson continue to run the operations. Now, Roy Hartsfield, I have a soft spot for Roy Hartsfield because he was the first manager of the Toronto Blue Jays. Bit of a surprise pick. In fact, according to reports, the Blue Jays were leaning towards signing either Yogi Berra or Warren Spahn as their first manager, but they chose Hartsfield, and it shouldn't have been a surprise because he was a very successful minor league manager and coach leading up to this point. Now, if Hartsfield sounds familiar to you, if you've ever flown through the Atlanta airport, otherwise known as Connection Hell, is also known as Hartsfield-Jackson International Airport. That is because Roy Hartsfield had a distant cousin, William Barry Hartsfield, a longtime two-time mayor of Atlanta and the namesake of the Hartsfield part of the airport. Now, Roy Hartsfield replaced Eddie Stanky at second base in Boston in 1950 and had a nice three-year run with the Braves. He was traded to Brooklyn for Andy Pafko in January 1953, but he would never play in the majors again. But that was okay because he was in the Dodger organization. He becomes a player manager in the minor leagues, eventually moves into the manager position, joins Walter Alston's coaching staff in 1969, and after a very long stretch of success as a minor league manager, becomes a hot commodity as a coach. Anytime there was a vacancy for a manager, it was Roy Hartsfield, whose name very quickly came up in the rumor mill. Now, he was with the Dodgers for a few years. He would go to Atlanta as a coach for a little bit, went back into managing in the Padres organization, and then, as I mentioned, was hired by the Blue Jays as their first manager prior to the 1977 season. He was not a very popular manager. He was not a player's coach. Let's put it that way. He was old school boot camp, ran things by, you know, almost military style. You know, you had to have short hair. There was no mustaches or beards on the team. He had a very, very thick training guide that players were supposed to stick to. And by the late 1970s, this was all Greek to any baseball player. They did not want rules like this. Hartsfield infamously was pretty much ousted by the players after a miserable 1979 season, still the worst season in Toronto Blue Jays history. Just didn't mesh well. And eventually Bobby Maddock would take over, and then Bobby Cox in Toronto. But after he was fired from the Blue Jays, he would later coach in the minors, scouted for Houston a little bit, and died back in 2011. A few other players here real quickly. Marion Fricano, also known as Frick, is best known for his headhunting pitches than anything else. He once beamed White Sox second baseman Cass Michaels so hard it knocked Michaels out of the game. And for the rest of the season, eventually his career, in fact, after Michaels got hit, he was administered last rites in the hospital. He had a severe concussion. They didn't know if he was going to pull through. He did. But the following spring training, Michaels is fainting. And he couldn't cut it anymore. For Cano, that was the most legendary case of beaning a ball player. He got into numerous beanball and fight situations. He appeared in 88 games over four seasons with the A's, first in Philadelphia, then Kansas City. Became a journeyman minor leaguer, I should say, in 1956. Interesting, after his baseball career, he became a teacher. Died from cancer at the age of 52 while he was vacationing in Tijuana. If you are in the town of North Collins, New York, which is near Buffalo, the town that Fricano was raised in, you will perhaps drive by the Marion J. Fricano Memorial Town Park. which was named in his honor. And finally, onto the 55 Bowman cards here. Ray Catt, the Giants catcher. He's with the Giants 1952 to 1956. Very interesting career path here. So Catt starts with the Giants. In June of 1956, he's traded to the St. Louis Cardinals in a pretty big deal. He, Al Dark, Don Little, and Whitey Lockman go to the Cardinals for Jackie Brandt, Dick Littlefield, Bill Sarney, Gordon Jones, and Red Shandeens. This would be the brief stretch of time where Shandeens was with the Giants and the Braves and the Reds. Of course, he was most famously connected to the Cardinals for much of his life. But he goes, Ray Catt goes from the Giants to the Cardinals. Well, after the 1956 season, he's traded back to the Giants, where he's there for 1957. Then in 1958, the Giants trade him back to the Cardinals. And then his pro career wound down. He later became a coach and a minor league manager. Then a high school and college coach in Texas, where he led Texas Lutheran University for 22 seasons. If you're on campus, Catt Isbell Field, the first part of that name, is in his honor. Toby Atwell, the other catcher here with the Pirates, don't have a lot of information on him, although I have read that he seriously injured his knee while sliding into a base in a minor league game in 1949, so his pro career almost ended before it started. But he would go on to play five seasons with the Cubs, Pirates, and Braves, and was actually the Cubs All-Star representative in 1952. Not to take anything away from Toby Atwell, but pretty much says a lot about the talent pool for the Chicago Cubs in 52. Even though he had a brief major league career, he was one of the best defensive catchers in the National League. And finally, Bob Kuzewa, as I mentioned, picked up World Series wins in 51, 52, and 53. He actually also got the save in the series clinching games in 1951 and 52. He also pitched in the final inning of Game 5 of the 53 series, all with the Yankees. He bounced around quite a bit, played for several teams in his career, but like I said, could be designated a lefty specialist. And he was nicknamed Sarge. Why? Because he served as an MP during World War II in India and Burma. In 2003, Kuzewa was inducted into the National Polish American Sports Hall of Fame and passed away not too long ago, May of 2017, at the young age of 94. So there are some fascinating stories about some of the players on these fascinating cards, the early 1950s Bowman cards. And like I said, I'm going to go to the card show this weekend and try to pick up a 53 Bowman, but a few other cards as well. And as I've always said, if you are interested in collecting vintage, unless it's a star player, try not to be too wrapped up in the condition of the cards. Now, you may luck out like I did. Like, you look at the Marian Fracano card number 3 of a set from 1953, or 1954 rather, it's in tremendous condition. Sometimes you'll luck out and you find those cards for a dollar or two. But, you know, don't be too much of a stickler, because the fact is, baseball cards were handled much differently by collectors, aka kids, back in the day. They were in bike spokes. They were wrapped tightly with rubber bands. They were manhandled and stuffed away in shoe boxes. They weren't meticulously taken care of like the cards are today. So if you if you're shopping for older cards, especially in the 1950s or 60s, as long as you're not a big stickler of the quality of the condition of the cards, you can find some incredible deals. So if you just want a handful of these cards, or you want a starter set, believe it or not, you can find some pretty decent deals on cards from the 50s and 60s. Mostly at card shows or card shops. You're not going to find too many of them online unless somebody's just trying to clear out a lot. You have to do a little digging, but it is well worth it in the end. You can come home with some great cards if you just do a little bit of homework and again, kind of lower the standards a little bit, unless you're getting, you know, that 55 Topps Jackie Robinson, or that 56 Topps Roberto Clemente. You know, unless it's a star card or a big name rookie card, don't be fixated on the condition. But, you know, you could still find some pretty decent shaped cards for pretty decent prices out there if you're willing to do the homework and look around for it. Well, that's going to wrap up our show. It was a lot of fun looking at these Bowman cards and the players behind the cards, and also J. William Bowman, the rather eccentric creator of the Bowman baseball card brand, and from that gum ink and the Bloney bubble gum that started everything. We're going to ship things again next week. We're going to go back into the junk wax era. Look for our poll on wax and gum stains on Twitter on Monday, as we will have the three options for you to choose. The top two vote-getting packs will be opened on our program next Friday, and we'll talk a little bit about the FLIR cards of the 1980s and also about some of the players that you see in those packs. Again, Wax and Gum Stains is the Twitter feed. Go ahead and make your comments throughout the week there. And if you would like to make a cash donation, Wax Ecstatic is open for business on PayPal, paypal.me/waxecstatic. Again, that's paypal.me/waxecstatic. If you've made a donation, thank you. If you haven't, we'd appreciate it. Continues to feed the machine here as we keep chugging along throughout the summer. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. You've been listening to Wax Ecstatic. Thanks again, and we will talk to you next week.